So let's begin with a bow. Welcome, everyone. We have some new people here tonight, so maybe we can just go around and introduce ourselves. Just maybe say your name and where you're from. So I'm Emily Weidman, and I'm one of three teachers. There's three of us here. We're all in a row, and I live in Waltham now.
Michael Fagan. I currently live in Newton.
Michael Bertolami. I am in Waltham now.
Gary Morrison, here in Waltham.
Chris DiNardo, and I'm in Waltham.
James West, in Belmont.
Kathleen Duncan, in Waltham.
I'm Adam Brighton, in Waltham.
Eileen, and I'm everywhere.
I'm Ruth, and I'm in Waltham, only temporarily.
Hi, I'm Harry. I'm from Brockton.
I'm Roberta. I'm from Waltham.
I'm Suzanne. I'm from Watertown, but I was born in Waltham. It's okay. Elise, I live here in Waltham.
Michael Levin from Waltham.
Good. Okay, thank you all. I know we have some new people, so don't worry. We are now in the third class of Module 4, but it's fine to join in at any time. It's always great. So you can also listen online to the first two talks if you wish, and anything that's handed out in class is online as a PDF. You can print it out at home. So in the first class, we talked about the importance of study and practice. It was an overview of the Tibetan Buddhist path, so the number of things that we covered there. And last week was the first week that we actually talked about the chapter. The book that we're using is online as a PDF, and we're going to use the first two chapters. And we started last week, and about halfway through what's called Class 1, The Path is the Goal. And this is part of the Nalanda Bodhi study curriculum. This is a teacher named Dzogchen Ponlop Rinpoche, who teaches mainly in Seattle, Washington. And this is part of the study curriculum for that group called Nalanda Bodhi. So we're going to use this. It is a really, we're beginning at the beginning of what's called the Hinayana path. And Hinayana means the lesser vehicle, and it's basically a path of individual salvation, you could say, or individual liberation. So it's about working on yourself and practicing meditation, studying, and really applying the fundamental Buddhist teachings to your own situation. So we're still in a general overview tonight, and next week we're going to start on what's called in the book Class 2, which is Chapter 2, and that's going to cover what's called here The Play of Confusion and Sanity, also known as the Four Truths. So that's what's coming next week, so it would be good to read that. And we're going to take quite a while to cover those four, so we might have some additional readings online. So I'd just like to kind of review just a little bit. We talked about a basic organizing principle called ground, path, and fruition. And I thought I would just ask if anyone would like to make a comment on what that means in terms of organizing the material, because this particular chapter was laid out very clearly with that. So would anyone like to take a stab at that in terms of what that actually means?
Try the first one.
The ground.
Yeah, just that's enough. We'll go around.
Okay.
And second one is a path, walking on, walking on the ground on the path.
Right, that's pretty good.
You have to have a ground, you have to have a path. So. Right. What do we mean by ground? I guess that's what we want to talk about. People get an understanding of what that might mean for themselves. It's a way of understanding, a way of presenting, kind of a form of logic, but it also relates to actually our path itself, how we actually proceed.
I'm looking at this, and I think I struggle with the idea that the ground is that inside of us is this Buddha nature. Because sometimes we think of the ground as what's out there that we can step on, as opposed to, like, we don't think of ourselves as the basic thing.
I think that can be confusing.
Okay.
Fundamental. Yeah. So it's the foundation or the, sort of the core or root.
Right.
That's another way. That's a very good distinction. Thank you. And my example, which is given sometimes of building a house, that's in the very relative approach here, so it can be a little confusing. But basically the ground is the core or the essence or the foundation. So there's different ways of seeing it.
People say they're grounded. They're
grounded. Yeah, grounded.
But the ground is Buddha nature. That is, we are Buddha nature, and it doesn't say it's inside or outside. It just says our nature is Buddha nature. We may not know what that is yet.
So Buddha nature is the ground?
Yes.
Okay. Right, Buddha nature is the ground. So in a way, it's like the view of the bigger picture as well as sort of the most fundamental.
As opposed to the ground is original sin, for example.
Right. Someone who was here last night brought that up. That was helpful. Different approach.
And is the ground also the belief that you do have within you the Buddha nature?
Yeah, in a way.
Well, it's not a belief so much.
It's not a belief. She says a starting place. It's a basis. So this is, we're not going to start with any belief at all. We're suspending any kind of belief. That's absolutely essential in terms of what we're doing. We're trying to learn something directly about ourselves and about reality. And so when we talk about the ground, it's where we start, and it's what we have to work with. So you could say now is the ground, because now is what we have to work with, right? I mean, it's very simple. But it's also just the basis for then understanding what we're doing with that. So the ground, in terms of our fundamental thing here, the ground is, even though we have Buddha nature, we don't know that, or we can't understand it, or we can't access it. That's the fundamental predicament we have as human beings. We also have the opportunity as human beings to be able to actually discover that and actually realize it.
Right. So, what about the path? What we could talk about what we generally mean by it, and then what is being presented as the path in this particular situation.
Exploring the ground.
Yeah.
And I mean, the ground is itself not a static thing. It's always changing. So. So we're always on some kind of path.
So there's a sense of movement, going forward. You could say inquiry. What else do we say? The way we travel, the means, the road, and the destination. Those are all things I thought of, but you may have some other ones. But basically, it's our, it's how we're moving forward. And this chapter is called The Path is the Goal, and we talked a little bit about that, too. So,
a sense of engagement.
That's
we already just have a sense of what this ground is about. Mm-hmm. And the engagement is the means by which we actually go towards making it, understanding it, realizing it, and so at the same time than Emily.
Yeah, so then what is the ground, what is the path in terms of this unfolding of our Buddha nature? If we, you know, you can listen to us say, well, the ground is Buddha nature, but how do we actually access that? What is the path here? Yes?
The first thing that occurred to me when you said what is the path was that it's our meditation practice.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yes, that's right, of course. Yes, because that's...
what to do.
Mm-hmm. Sorry?
That's what we're told.
That's what you're told to do.
That would be the path. Everybody meditate, but that's not the way to go.
That's not the way. We're going to put a lot of effort into that and then tell you forget it. No, we won't. We won't. We remind you every week how important it is. So that's an excellent answer. So meditation is the path or the way we actually access this Buddha nature. And it's with the teachings talk a lot about the Buddha nature being covered over. So what would that mean in terms of, like, what are the elements that seem to cover over our Buddha nature? And when do we experience the Buddha nature? Do we have glimpses of it at any point in our life? Or does it seem like a completely unattainable thing?
Seems to me intent is an important part of the path. That one has an intent to be in harmony with the ground, whatever that is, then one has to let go of, you know, whatever may distract one from being simply exposed to the ground.
And what would you do with your intent? Would there be further, how would your intent actually help you connect with your Buddha nature?
Let go of whatever I seem to demand, or whatever I'm convinced, or whatever I'm, you know, representing it must be.
Like a fixed idea, you mean?
Yeah, mm-hmm. An idea. So since we're trying to experience what we really don't know, we have to continually have an intent to be willing to experience what mm-hmm. we don't know.
Mm-hmm. An openness, then.
It's sort of an unconditional. Mm-hmm. Attitude.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Yeah. Yeah. So it said also the path then is, well, actually, the what he talks about in this chapter, what is the path is getting to know our own mind and how our mind functions. And then what emotions are rising and how we deal with them. So those are some of the aspects of what was brought out in this particular chapter.
Oh, good question.
Yeah.
You just asked the question of can we ever know our Buddhist, our nature?
Buddha nature.
Mm-hmm. And does it even really exist? Is that what you asked? Is it really, can we ever do that?
Well, I said, can you access it, or can yeah. Can you find it? Or
so was Buddha's experience of awakening that what you're describing?
Yes.
The awakening is was his getting to know his true nature.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
So that answers
right. So what I talked about last week, because we did go over this last week, so it's actually helpful to revisit it, that the Buddha went through a period in his life where he did a lot of aesthetic practices and mortification of the flesh and stopped eating and whatever, and he tried that. He tried a lot of different things in his life, but he was really searching for something and looking at the nature of his mind. So he decided to sit down and just sit under the Bodhi tree and sit there until he could penetrate to the truth of reality. And there's more to the story in terms of what came up for him and how he did that, but he really saw through to, you could say, the ultimate nature, the true nature. So that's the story, and the path was, for him, that path of meditation. But initially he didn't teach because he didn't think he could tell people how that, what that was. And it is something no one really can tell you, so we always sit here and talk about it, and then we say we can't tell you. But by example of different metaphors and things it's taught, but we actually experience it within our own meditation practice when there is some sense of space or gap, and there's a chance to actually connect with something that's not emotional upheavals or busy, crazy mind. So we can experience that from time to time.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Good. Good question. All right, so I'd like to move on now to the part of the chapter that is view, meditation, and action. So we're continuing now, and I'd like to talk about the what I have in this sheet. I just wrote down the fundamental view of Buddhism. would you like to read this paragraph, the first part?
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay.
From a Buddhist point of view, whether we analyze the outer physical world or the inner world of our minds, we neither find any solid or inherent existence, nor do we stop our investigation at some point for our egos to still feel safe. But we can continue venturing into the big, wide open. Then we can see that the ground, or the basic view, is groundlessness. Everything keeps changing, moment by moment, and nothing is what it seems to be. In order for this to affect our habitual fixed patterns for dealing with the world and eventually gaining a broader outlook that informs our actions, we need to progressively familiarize ourselves with this basic state of affairs and, unlike said scientists, make it a living experience. In other words, Buddhism is all about integrating the results of our analysis of the seeming existence of the world into our daily experience so that as to affect our habitual fixed patterns of dealing with our lives and eventually gain a wider outlook that serves to inform our actions in a way that is beneficial for both ourselves and others. In other words...
Why don't you stop there? Okay. The last part is the summary, for sure. Well, you can read the last sentence. Go
in ahead. Other words, analyzing the problems in our life and recognizing them for what they are, identifying the causes for these problems, and then learning about and applying the proper remedies are what make up the Buddha's path.
So that's a lot. So we could break it down. Do people have the text with them? Well, you have it. So some people have that. So he's saying here that the basic view is groundlessness. Everything keeps changing moment by moment, and nothing is what it seems to be. So what does that mean to people in terms of that as the basic view? Basically, he's pointing here to impermanence and things changing constantly and the groundlessness of the shiftiness underneath. Everything is shifting and changing.
I've heard more of like a groundlessness of perception rather than a groundlessness of permanence. You know, like, what can you base your perception of the world on? And then I think part of the quote was that part of the path is integrating your perception into a coherent experience. And so that's kind of your ground, is just a coherent perception.
Boy, that would take a lot of work. How are you going to do that? Well, okay, sorry.
Wait.
Meditate.
Well, maybe. Yeah, but if you don't, yeah. First of all, what you already have is a lot of curiosity, which is great. Okay. So we're not trying to construct some different way of doing anything. That's the part I would disagree with, okay? We're simply letting things be rather than keeping building a perception. Whatever our perception is, it's fine. We're going to leave our perception alone. We're not trying to cure it or become tuned into some other perception. So that is the most important thing right now to work with, that we're doing less and less to perturb our minds or to force them or to do anything unnatural. Otherwise, trying to gain enlightenment would be a very unnatural thing. It would be like saying, well, if I practice, I can walk on stilts, and maybe that's a better way to walk. So where does that leave you?
Oh, okay. But I guess sometimes I try to think, but the groundlessness is, we like to say, like, I'm this kind of person, and this is the way that kind of person is, because then we like have this view of how things are now and were and will be, and that's we can know. Like, I can know what's going to happen tomorrow because I know what kind of person I'm going to meet. Like, the person I'm going to deal with is going to be the same as the person I dealt with today. And in fact, that's not the case. Really. That person's not the same. I'm not the same. The world's not the same. But there's a comfort to thinking that I know what's going to happen. And that's the piece that you have to let go of, because it's a comfort that's not real. It's a facade to sort of feel safe.
So how do you penetrate that? Because that's, how do you see that? How do you recognize that?
Well, she already said it was a willingness to go beyond, out of the comfort
right.
zone.
Mm-hmm. Right. It was a piece of even saying to yourself, today I did this, tomorrow I could do a different
right.
thing.
Yeah.
I don't have to be
right.
the person who does this.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I am not, you know, the adjective that describes me. I am what I'm doing now.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
And so there's that piece sometimes of pushing yourself to choose now, what do I want to do, as opposed to mm-hmm. I will always do this.
Right. So therefore you're able to live mm-hmm. in a state that's more open and not so fixed, and therefore there's more freedom within that. And ultimately, I think we're looking at how to be in the world in a state that's more open and free, because we're willing to live in the moment and not live solid with so many solid concepts. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so what I said before was kind of off the mark, in that we're not really looking for a coherence among what we see. Like, we just we just see what we see, and it doesn't have to make sense, and we don't have to make a narrative out of it.
Yeah, no construction.
We just have to be
right.
receptive to it.
Right. At what? Yes, exactly. So we're not constructing anything. We're looking, yeah, and being present to what's really there. Because we know, like, if we, let's say we see something, but we've got some big concept going and our mind's busy, and we rarely see things. A lot of times we don't even see the world we're in, because we're so busy being distracted and thinking about other things. So again, it's kind of cutting away all of that and having more direct perception of reality. And actually, what did you think of the Snickers bar? Do you remember reading that part? I thought that was pretty funny. So he's talking at that point about experience, and so the study and experience is the section that follows the view, meditation, and action. And The study he talks about here is working with analysis, studying these teachings, but also really penetrating through analysis this fixation on ego. And that's a real key point that he talks about in terms of the path. So in the path, we're working with this solidification of ego. We talked about the cocoon last week, and this view of the self being very fixed. And the other, what we're working with also is cutting through these habitual patterns, including some of the emotional patterns that we've established, and really seeing through that, and there's liberation in that, like cutting through a lot of these patterns. So the study and meditation are a way of opening further to this Buddha nature, you could say, and this awake quality that we have.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Seems to me the two things going on is if you think of Buddha under the tree, it's saying, I'm going to find out where the bottom line is. Well, I suppose there was no bottom line. You know, in other words, the groundlessness or whatever word you're using is, you just kept getting back and back and back, and he said there's no end to it. So he called it, you know, groundless or transient or whatever you want. So then, in all practicality, we still have to live in the world, so he had to eat and do everything else. So that's... the way to deal with that then is to be fluid. If there's nothing ultimately at the bottom, then you got to go with the flow. And that supposedly is can be polluted with what you call fixations. Mm-hmm. And so to be open to the fact that things are bottomless, one has to avoid fixations, but yet the daily activity, the representations that the mind creates, is at least a practical way of dealing with a fluid reality.
You said bottomless. How is that an image for groundlessness?
Well, whichever way you look, there's no end to it. In other words, bottomless, we're using a word that makes us think downwards, but bottomless can be anything in terms of intellectual activity or, you know, physical activity. It could be like the cosmic dust from the Big Bang.
Well, that's a theory, but if you walk down the street, is it bottomless or groundless?
Yeah, well, I have no idea. It's non-resolvable.
What is?
A groundless conclusion is simply the mind practically saying, okay, it's non-determinate.
Non-what?
Determinate.
Non-determined.
So it's groundless. It's sort of an absence of clarity.
So there's no end to inquiry?
Yeah, that's what I like about
your, everything.
Yeah, I like your word exploration, because there's no end to it.
Well, one of the points that was brought up here, which is very important to understand from the very beginning, is we have a way of presenting this in terms of two truths, relative and absolute. When we talk about what you call bottomless, we're talking about some inexhaustible dimension, which is reality itself. It can't be pinned down. It's not something that is determinate. At the same time, the only way we can proceed at all is to work with where we are. And this is relative truth. This is our current situation. Where are we? What are we working with? How is our mind working? And at the same time, what we begin to understand with Buddha nature is that it's fundamental, complete sanity. It's not just some kind of unknowable thing beyond anything at all. It actually has a lot to do with just basically very, very feet on the ground kind of capacity to be completely right here and now. It doesn't have a big trail of explanations huddling around it or asterisks and footnotes. So the point that's brought up here, properly understanding, and then seeing through the confusion in our relative reality is the means to see ultimate reality. Is that clear? If you read the text, I mean, it goes into it in mm-hmm. detail.
It does go into it.
In other words, we have to work with what we have, what seems to be the case in the world as we know it, and how things actually are. Because how things actually are is fundamentally absolute, but the way we know it is relative, which is a constantly shifting and ephemeral kind of thing. Right? We work on a whole series of assumptions and associations which are all relative and most of them highly incorrect, particularly when we freeze them into some sense of concept. Mm-hmm. Because that's, as you say, it just programs us into this sense of thinking we have an understanding of the world and making predictability, notions of predictability, when in fact it's actually way beyond that. And mm-hmm. we're closing ourselves off when we actually closing ourselves off to this dimension by shuttering our minds with these opinions and fixed beliefs about the way things are, of how we're supposed to perceive things and what they're supposed to be. And we're doing this to each other. Mm-hmm. So it's a very big concatenation of not just my own personal mm-hmm. life that's creating these perceptions, but I'm also being affected by everybody else's perceptions that are also affecting me, right? And each other. We're all doing this to each other. So that's the predicament we have in terms of our fundamental confusion.
So is it kind of like we're all in this dance together? Yeah. And that we stop for a moment and, you know, not necessarily change partners, but, you know, just it's like you're in this dance and then it's like, okay, let's stop for a second.
Allow there to be a gap.
Allow there to be a gap and then start dancing again. Or not dancing.
What do you see in the gap? What would the gap be?
Well, I think the gap would be that calm spot, that, you know, that connectedness, the groundedness. That would seem to be
the basic ground, like right. Buddha nature, or right. that space of awareness.
Does it come down to just like a profound sense of openness, just not having like prefixed notions and judgments about what we experience, and trying to just be completely open to things being interrelated and connected in some way, and not having our own fixed experience about what we think is happening?
That is all. That is exactly what we're told.
Yeah.
How are we going to do it? Basically, I think the gap is that for a moment I stopped the narrative of the whole world and everything in my mind and everything out there is about me. Because that's what we do, and we may not know we're doing it, and the meditation of going back to the breath is the discipline that somehow we get a glimpse of. I'm always telling a story about me. And if there's a little gap in it, then we start to see something. We haven't rearranged ourselves to tap a universal database. We haven't all of a sudden looked from over there in someone else's eyes if I'm over here with my eyes. Nothing has changed except that the story got dropped either for an instant or maybe in the Buddha's case for a much longer time.
So is that the moment when you see the Buddha nature? Is it you and you're in the Buddha nature?
Yes, yeah, so we get it. microseconds or in 5 seconds or in 3 days or a lifetime, or we keep working at it.
Because we're always referring back to ourself, and we're seeing things from that point of view, me, me, me. And as Michael said, the meditation is powerful because you're getting these little glimpses through that wall of that cocoon that you're always looking out through, which is being always surrounded by, you know, ideas of you. So you're starting to penetrate through that when you are able to actually drop your thought pattern, even just for a moment, recognize and come to the breath. It starts to cut through that habitual fixation. And that's why the meditation is so important. The other aspect of being able to penetrate this is through analysis, and that we're going to work with more as we get into the Four Noble Truths and how we build ego and how we can start to deconstruct it a little bit. I wanted to just read something from, again, this is from The Profound Treasury of the Ocean of Dharma by Trungpa Rinpoche, and this explains, I think it's a very interesting section on meditation. So this is within the view, basically, the view of the path. So it's under practice. Meditation transcending spirituality. Any meditation practice we might be doing, such as shamatha vipassana practice, should transcend even the highest concept of spirituality. Both the ordinary lower-level world and the so-called spiritual or higher-level world are very materialistic, and meditation practice should be able to go beyond that. In meditation, we are not trying to overcome or to defeat anything, and we are not trying to gain any level of high spiritual achievement for the sake of pleasure. Since the practice of meditation is not at all geared to pleasure, its achievement should also be beyond pleasure. And since it transcends pleasure, it also transcends pain. But transcending pain and developing peace are byproducts of meditation practice rather than an immediate aim. So the practice of meditation, a lot of times people think, well, I'm meditating to get to be peaceful or relaxed or whatever, but that is, he's saying here, is a byproduct of meditation, possibly. But basically, we're actually going beyond that, and we're going beyond seeking pleasure or seeking or trying to avoid pain. But the meditation practice is really a way to cut through on a deeper level, both of that, all of that. So I hope that was helpful. I just keep finding things to, you know, to try to expand a little bit. So we have a little time left. So let's see just where we are. Yes.
So back to your questions about relative absolute is where, when we have this glimpse, this glimpse is beyond. We have no idea how to put words to it, but one of the things is it's not like pleasure or pain or that you associate with this reality we're talking about. It's just what it is. So beyond being able to put it into a box, frame it into a concept, or in any way take it home with you for your own keeping, and it has nothing to do with just making you feel good. Those things, if they happen, which they do, if they're done for that sake, then you're going to miss the whole point. You're just talking yourself, hypnotizing yourself into feeling relaxed or calm, and you're not really going towards realizing the truth. So that's a very important point. And that's what he's, another way of putting what he's saying about getting sort of on a spiritual jag, where I need to get spiritual now and enough of that other stuff.
Girls don't like me.
That's okay. Bring your questions.
I was just thinking about the whole thing that you know, that gap, you know, with meditation that we're getting away from all the things that are going on in our heads, and we're just, we're in that moment. Is it that, I guess what I think is, it's like we're connecting with that collective unconscious or whatever that connects everything together, that in that little gap of a gap of time, or maybe it's a glimmer of that, boom, there's something else out there, like, you know.
Well, that's what Carl Jung said.
What's that?
That's what Carl Jung said.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
It's not what the Buddha said.
So why don't you contrast it then? I think that's
because you're talking about penetrating the central mystery. And the Buddha found that there is no central mystery. So you can try it, but in fact, you can try it any way you like, and as long as there's no deception about whether you found it or whether you've found something hypnotic. Yeah.
I'm getting confused because it seems like the point of the meditation is to be aware, awareness. And it's also like we're supposed to let go thinking we have a self. But we're also, it seems contradictory to, we're supposed to know our own mind because we don't have a self.
Whose mind is it?
Yeah. Like, you know, I'm having trouble.
That is knowing the mind. Precisely what you're saying.
I have no idea what you're
discovering
saying.
Discovering that. No ego.
Discovering, I have no mind.
Yeah. Discovering you have no ego is fundamentally knowing your mind.
Okay, that doesn't make any sense.
Right. Right.
Well, okay, then let's go back to ground zero then.
Greek.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're following your breath, and then some thought comes up. What is the instruction?
To let the thought go and notice that it's a thought. And
you're going to kill this thought and stamp on it?
No, notice it.
You know, okay.
And you go back to your breathing. Mm-hmm.
So what have you learned?
That I had a thought.
Yeah. Okay, so you do that for quite a while. What do you learn?
I have lots of
thoughts. There you go.
Right. I have monkey mind. I have, you know, lots of thoughts, lots of feelings.
Yeah.
It's hard to get to the awareness.
Well, you're trying to get to it. Do you find a self?
It's hard for me to think of the no self. I went to a little bit. I was late for the Anam Tumpton lecture, but I thought, I'm really good at buying the books, so I have stacks of books in my house, which I'll never live long enough to read.
Yeah, but I didn't ask you if you found a non-self. I asked you if you found a self.
Well, I feel like I have a self. But there was a book there.
Yes.
No self,
right.
No problem.
Yeah. Right.
And I was going to buy it. But, and I thought, no! And I put it back because it was too scary.
You don't want to be talked into believing that, do you?
Right.
But that's what we were told one time, we have no self.
And I know.
Like, oh, wait, you know, but I'm really confused.
But you weren't told to believe that you have no self.
But I hear here. I mean, I hear the instructions are that I'm not supposed to have.
Uh-uh.
I mean, I'm supposed to get to know my own mind, but I'm not supposed to have a self. But
wait, you're going to learn your own mind if you just do the instruction, because you'll learn what's on your mind. You'll learn thoughts are on your mind. You'll learn emotions are on your mind.
But I also hear that I'm not supposed to have any ego. And it's all about me, and that's bad.
No one said any supposed.
That's the wrong thing.
No one said any supposed.
I heard that all, you know, Emily
It's not that machine.
Yes, but family study, that's something, isn't it? You're supposed to believe it.
That we're
definitely don't believe anything I say.
Anything else. But that, you know, all of our orientation is me, 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 me. And that somehow we should do something other than that.
Well, it's not that you have to do something other. It's that all that me, me, me ultimately fails in being a self, but that's something you might have to discover.
Are you considering the mind and the self to be two different things?
Okay, okay.
Because it sounds like that's what...
The mind is whatever it's doing, okay? That's mind. And we're discovering mind all the time. And meditation throws the light back on the mind instead of out there, right? You see that. Because you're not giving the mind something else to do, right? So it starts to see the thoughts. So, does that make it a self? We don't quite know what a self is.
But isn't, like, if we're having thoughts?
Yeah.
I mean...
Oh, then I'm having a thought, right?
Yeah. You're jumping to conclusions.
Oh, okay. So to say there are thoughts, not that I'm having thoughts.
See, thoughts create the thinker.
Thoughts.
Okay, well, I remember the holy... thing is, they don't say the boy ran or I ran. They say running occurred. So there was thinking, but it wasn't me thinking. But how am I supposed to get my mind get to know my mind? You said my mind. You know? Well, so yeah. That is the concept of there being
a self
that has a mind.
What you're saying is very, first of all, it's very deep in our own culture because René Descartes, it was, who said, "I think, therefore I am." Okay, so we got to challenge that a little.
So there is a self. If we're able to question whether there is a self,
what?
Yeah, right.
You're saying
as long as you're able to question whether you have a self, then there is a self.
No, as long as you're able to ask if it has a self, then you can certainly conclude that a question is being asked.
You don't have to. Subject is asking this question.
How do you? Subject is? Originating. Oh, where's that subject?
That subject. It doesn't have to be aware. It just has to be an is.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
There is a subject posing this question. You know, and
you're telling me that.
Asking, do I exist?
If that's the question you're asking, yeah.
Then the fact that you're a subject asking, do I exist, means you exist.
But you just made a jump. You said therefore the I is asking. There's an I that's asking the question.
Yeah.
The issue is not whether all these experiences are happening to you. The issue is whether there's an owner of it.
Okay.
Okay, is there an owner of it? What would that owner be like? First of all, the owner has to sort of sit there and own it. The owner has to... can't be the same thing as the process. Therefore, it's something that owns the process, that thinks, I have this process. Can you find anything like that? Keep looking.
That's the point.
Exactly. Right. That's the point.
So, is the reason that there's no self because self keeps changing? Or is the reason that there's no self the only time I can let go of self is maybe sort of what Gary was saying. I can let go of having a self when I think that I'm different every day. So I don't have a fixed self. Or I can let go of the idea of having a self when I think I'm just part of the universe. I'm just
a bunch of molecules here. You know, and when I die, it's a really sort of nice thought to become dirt.
Just dissolve your parts.
I would like to nourish.
Or that the self that's having this conversation right now is the same self that has to pay attention to the job tomorrow. Is it the same self?
So is the reason... No, because the self changes from moment to moment to moment.
Okay.
But does that mean that there is no self at all because it's changing?
Well, we're not denying that there's memory, that you'll be a bit different because you had this conversation, or you'll be different because anything particular happened to you and changed you. There's constant change going on in you.
Right. So I can accept that I have no fixed self.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I still feel like I have a changing self.
Okay.
I'll be the dirt.
Well, okay, that's good. Now, why is the changed self the same self as, or why is that changing self the same as the previous self?
I'll be wearing the same clothes tomorrow.
Oh. Okay.
I just put them on.
Oh, so if I put on those clothes, I'd be yourself?
Yeah, you could try.
I'm not asking
which self.
What?
I have, you know, which self?
Which?
There are
which,
so many
okay.
different
which
self.
Okay.
Something yeah. claiming in my mind that this is me. And so I have my me when I wake up, I have my me when I have my coffee, and then I have my me when I see somebody I like, and then when I see somebody I don't like, I have another me.
Yeah.
You know, all these are these different little
yeah.
me's
yeah.
that are all forming this grand construction which I call self. But just like you are willing to acknowledge that what you consider yourself is a constant state of change or made up of all these different multiple identities, what we actually discover in the process of meditation, and that's why it's not a question of you must believe or you should not believe in a self. It's a question of you're determining for yourself whether this is you.
For yourself.
In other words, when you understand for yourself, if you investigate and you can't find this so-called self or selves, if you know, let's just talk in either the multiple or the singular, it doesn't matter, but we are looking for this self. We want to actually find out if it's there, because the Buddha tried.
Do we?
Yeah, the Buddha tried. I mean, believe me, he really worked hard at trying to find himself.
I didn't
himself.
Know he was trying to find himself.
Oh, absolutely.
He was trying to do something else.
Find it. This has been a very famous statement that all the Buddhas of the past, not only just a historical Buddha, but all these various beings who achieved enlightenment, they've all been looking for this self, and they can't find it.
I thought he was looking for something else. I forget what it was.
Enlightenment?
So it's like the Holy Grail.
No. It's too immediate to be anything grand and lofty.
It's something very simple here. We only want to stay practical, you know, straightforward, and pay attention to what we can actually work with as it is, mm-hmm. and not get grandiose. This is not a project like that. We're learning how to work with moment to moment. How can I? And we're actually discovering, which we'll explore, is how this is fundamentally learning how to be genuine, which is just really being fully present. It's not a self-conscious identity that you're carrying around, a placard you wear on your chest going, aha, you know, me.
Okay, let's hear it.
Are you using the word self differently than psychologists and psychiatrists?
Okay, we're going to provide, in about 3 weeks, we're going to actually give you a definition of it.
2 weeks.
Self?
2 weeks.
I think we'll get into
Roberta can hardly wait.
Can you answer my question? Last time we did this, I got like really cuckoo.
But you need to know that your questioning right now is the way in.
Okay.
And it's very important. And this, like, I'm so confused, I don't get it. What are you telling me? And what is that? All of that is the way in. And this is analysis, and this is how you begin to actually get to the root of it and understand it, because you're willing to look.
Marty and Gary, who come here
yes.
on a pretty regular basis, Marty told me that after that session when I got upset, she said that you folks were using self differently than the psychology people use self.
I think so, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
because
okay, that would be helpful for
yes,
me to know.
That's valid.
Yes, we're not using it to mean personality.
Otherwise, I've wasted a lot of money.
No, it's different. Okay. But you have to. It's very important for you to pretend to have a self, though. Suppose I rob a bank, and then I get caught and I get hauled in front of the judge, and I say, well, that was a different self that robbed the bank.
Yeah, I mean, if I don't have a self,
in the
I need to report to McLean Hospital or
okay.
something.
Right.
Okay. Or I could say, actually, I'm just many, many selves. That was a very panicked, greedy self that robbed the bank. Right now, I'm a very calm, collected, reasonable self, so I shouldn't be punished for it.
Okay, great. This is helpful.
Right, and these questions are fabulous. So, this is exactly where we're going. We're going to look at this self and really break it down into all these, you know, different ways of seeing it. And ultimately, the point is that we each question for ourselves. We find it ourselves that there is no self, even the self that looks.
But there are components.
There are components
that make up the psychological complex. And so there is a functional self, psychologically. Obviously, we all know that. That's how we function.
Well, yeah.
We're not trying to eradicate that. We're not going through it. That doesn't make any sense.
It's not like that. No. No.
Okay, so it's not intended. The path is not intended to make anyone dysfunctional.
Right.
For one
thing. Or crazy.
Or crazy.
That's
right. Next time we'll just lie in a fetal position.
And we are contained within unnecessary limitations by fear. Therefore, the experience of confusion and panic, if we push here, is something we do have to work with.
Mm-hmm. Acknowledge it.
Yeah.
Right. So.
Is that puzzling?
Nope.
No. Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. So it's important to keep coming back because you don't want to be left in this state.
The no self.
They'll come and get us.
So next time, Michael's going to...
So next time, you're here next week, right?
I'm playing.
Okay, very good. So we're going to begin the Four Noble Truths, and Michael will introduce that and work with the first one, I believe. And so start reading, and well, read that next chapter, and we'll be working with that for a while. And then Michael's going to dive into... topics that we've been touching on tonight on
the cause of suffering,
which is
the second noble
the self.
Whatever that is.
I had to Google it. I thought, I'm supposed to know these things and I have no idea. So I ended up in Wikipedia.
Looking for yourself.
Where, and you typed in, where is Roberta?
You Googled your name?
I read about the Four Noble Truths. I thought I was supposed to know them.
That's okay.
Good.
That's good. Well, we're gonna work on it, and we're going to go through it for several weeks. We'll spend our time and bring your questions. This is really important because bringing your questions is what makes the material come alive and become meaningful for you. So we will say our dedication of merit and conclude.